almost as miraculous as that of Lazarus. "Oh, this is terrible, terrible," she said in a faint, fluttery voice. Holding onto the table, she managed to pull herself to her feet. She stood swaying, little straggles of hair hanging around her face among the muskrat tails of her cap. "Are you well enough?" he asked, more kindly. "If not, then I must carry on as best I can by myself." She drew a deep, shuddering breath and let it out. The side-to-side sway stopped. She turned and walked toward the pantry. "There's a pair of spades in the shed out back," she said. "A pick as well, I think. Throw them in your trap. And there's half a bottle of gin out here in the pantry. Been here untouched since Bill died 5 years ago on Lammas night. I'll have a bit and then I'll join you, Mr. Jeffrey. You're a brave woman, Mrs. Ramage. Be quick." "Aye, never fear me," she said, and grasped the bottle of gin with a hand that trembled only slightly. There was no dust on the bottle. Not even the pantry was safe from the relentless dust cloud of Mrs. Ramage. But the label reading Clough and Poor Boozers was yellow. "Be quick yourself." She had always hated spirits, and her stomach wanted to sick the gin with its nasty junipery smell and oily taste back up. She made it stay down. Tonight, she would need it. Chapter 6. Under clouds that still raced east to west, blacker shapes against a black sky, and a moon that was now settling toward the horizon, the pony trap sped toward the churchyard. It was now Mrs. Ramage who drove, cracking the whip over the bewildered Mary, who would have told them, if horses could talk, that this was all wrong, that she was supposed to be dozing in her warm stall come this time of night. The spades and the pick chattered coldly one against the other, and Mrs. Ramage thought they would have given anyone who had seen them a proper fright. They must look like a pair of Mr. Dickens' resurrection men, or perhaps one resurrection man sitting in a pony trap driven by a ghost. For she was all in white, had not even paused long enough to gather up her robe. Her nightgown fluttered around her stout, vein-puffed ankles, and the tails of her cap streamed wildly out behind her. Here was the church. She turned Mary up the lane which ran beside it, shivering at the ghostly sound the wind played along the eaves. She had a moment to wonder why such a holy place as a church should seem so frightening after dark, and then realized it was not the church, it was the errand. Her first thought upon coming out of her faint was that my Lord must help them. Hadn't he been there in all things, through thick and thin, never wavering? A moment later she realized how mad the idea was. This was not a matter of my Lord's courage, but of his very sanity. She hadn't needed Mr. Jeffrey to tell her so. The memory of Miss Evelyn Hyde had done that. She realized that neither Mr. Jeffrey nor my Lord had been in Little Dunthorpe when it happened. This had been almost half a year ago in the spring. Misery had entered the rosy summer of her pregnancy, morning sickness behind her, the final rising of her belly and its attendant discomfort still ahead, and she had cheerfully sent the two men off for a week of grouse shooting and card playing and footballing and heaven alone knew what other masculine foolishness at Oak Hall in Doncaster. My Lord had been a bit doubtful, but Misery assured him she would be fine, and nearly pushed him out the door. That Misery would be fine, Mrs. Ramage had no doubt. But whenever my Lord and Mr. Jeffrey left for Doncaster, she wondered if one of them, or perhaps both, might not return on the back of a cart, toes up. Oak Hall was the inheritance of Albert Fossington, a schoolmate of Jeffrey's and Ian's. Mrs. Ramage quite rightly believed that Bertie Fossington was mad. Some 3 years ago, he had eaten his favorite polo pony, after it had broken two legs and needed to be destroyed. It was a gesture of affection, he said. "Learned it from the fuzzy wuzzies in Cape Town," he said. "Griquas. Wonderful chaps. Put sticks and things in their smooches, what? Some of them look like they could carry all 12 volumes of the Royal Navigation Charts on the lower lips, ha-ha. Taught me that each man must eat the thing he loves. Rather poetic in a grisly sort of way, what?" In spite of such bizarre behavior, Mr. Jeffrey and my Lord retained a great affection for Bertie. "I wonder if that means they'll have to eat him when he's dead," Mrs. Ramage had once wondered after a visit from Bertie, during which he had tried to play croquet with one of the house cats, quite shattering its poor little head. And they had spent nearly 10 days at Oak Hall this past spring. not more than a day or two after they left, Miss Charlotte Evelyn Hyde of Storping on Firkill had been found dead on the back lawn of her home, Cove of Birches. There had been a freshly picked bunch of flowers near one outstretched hand. The village doctor was a man named Bilford, a capable man by all accounts. Nevertheless, he had called old Dr. Shinebone in to consult. Bilford had diagnosed the fatal malady as a heart attack, although the girl was very young, only 18, and had seemed in the pink of health. Bilford was puzzled. Something seemed not at all right. Old Shinny had been clearly puzzled as well, but in the end he had concurred with a diagnosis. So did most of the village, for that matter. The girl's heart had not been properly made, that was all. Such things were rare, but everyone could recall such a sad case at one time or another. It was probably this universal concurrence that had saved Bilford's practice, if not his head, following the ghastly denouement. Although everyone had agreed that the girl's death was puzzling, it had crossed no one's mind that she might not be dead at all. 4 days following the interment, an elderly woman named Mrs. Soames, Mrs. Ramage knew her slightly, had observed something white lying on the ground of the Congregational Church's cemetery as she entered it to put flowers on the grave of her husband, who had died the previous winter. It was much too big to be a flower petal, and she thought it might be a dead bird of some sort. As she approached, she became more and more sure that the white object was not just lying on the ground, but protruding from it. She came 2 or 3 hesitant steps closer yet, and observed a hand reaching from the earth of a fresh grave, the fingers frozen in a hideous gesture of supplication. Blood-streaked bones protruded from the ends of all the digits, save the thumb. Mrs. Soames ran shrieking from the cemetery, ran all the way into Storping's High Street, a run of nearly 1.25 miles, and reported her news to the barber, who was also the local constable. Then she had collapsed in a dead faint. She took to her bed later that afternoon and did not arise from it for nearly 1 month, nor did anyone in the village blame her in the least. The body of the unfortunate Miss Evelyn Hyde had been exhumed, of course, and as Geoffrey Alliburton drew Mary to a halt in front of the gate leading into Little Dunthorpe's C of E churchyard, Mrs. Ramage found herself wishing fervently that she had not listened to the tales of the exhumation. They had been dreadful. Dr. Bilford, shaken to within 1 inch of sanity himself, diagnosed catalepsy. The poor woman had apparently fallen into some sort of death-like trance, much like the sort those Indian fakers could voluntarily induce in themselves before allowing themselves to be buried alive, or to have needles passed through their flesh. She had remained in this trance for perhaps 48 hours, perhaps 60. Long enough, at any rate, to have awakened not to find herself on her back lawn where she had been picking flowers, but buried alive in her own coffin. She had fought grimly for her life, that girl, and Mrs. Ramage found now, following Geoffrey through the gates and into a thin mist that turned the leaning grave markers into islands, that what should have redeemed with nobility only made it seem all the more horrid. The girl had been engaged to be married. In her left hand, not the one frozen above the soil like the hand of a drowned woman, had been her diamond engagement ring. With it she had slit the satin lining of her coffin, and over God knew how many hours she had used it to claw away at the coffin's wooden lid. In the end, air running out, she had apparently used the ring with her left hand to cut and excavate, and her right hand to dig. It had not been quite enough. Her complexion had been a deep purple from which her blood-rimmed eyes stared in a bulging expression of terminal horror. The clock in the church tower began to chime the hour of 12, the hour when, her mother had told her, the door between life and death sways open a bit, and the dead may pass both ways. And it was all Mrs. Ramage could do to keep herself from shrieking and fleeing in a panic, which would not abate, but grow stronger with each step. And if she began running, she knew she would simply run until she fell down insensible. "Stupid, fearful woman," she berated herself, and then amended that to, "Stupid, fearful, selfish woman. It's my lord you want to be thinking of now, not your own fears. My lord, and if there is even one chance that my lady..." Ah, but no. It was madness to even think of such a thing. It had been too long, Too long. Too long. Geoffrey had led her to Misery's tombstone, and the two of them stood looking down at it, as if mesmerized. Lady Calthorpe, the stone read. Other than the dates of her birth and death, the only inscription was, "Loved by many." She looked at Geoffrey and said, like one awakening from a deep daze, "You've not brought the tools." "No, not yet," he responded, and threw himself full length on the ground and placed his ear against the earth, which had already begun to show the first tender shoots of new grass between the rather carelessly replaced sods. For a moment, the only expression she saw there by the lamp she carried was the one Geoffrey had worn since she had first opened the door to him, a look of agonized dread. Then a new expression began to surface. This new expression was one of utter horror mingled with an almost demented hope. He looked up at Mrs. Ramage, eyes staring, mouth working. "I believe she lives," he whispered strengthlessly. "Oh, Mrs. Ramage!" Suddenly he turned over onto his belly and screamed at the ground. Under other circumstances it would have been comic.
"Misery! Misery! We're here! We know! Hold on! Hold on, my darling!"
He was on his feet a moment later, sprinting back toward the pony trap where the digging tools were, his slippered feet sending the placid ground mist into excited little roils. Mrs. Ramage's knees unlocked, and she buckled forward, near to swooning again. Of its own accord, seemingly, her head slipped to one side, so her right ear was pressed against the ground. She had seen children in similar postures by the railway line, listening for trains. And she heard it. Low, painful scraping sounds in the earth. Not the sounds of a burrowing animal, these. These were the sounds of fingers scraping helplessly on wood. She drew in breath, in one great convulsive gulp, restarting her own heart, it seemed. She shrieked,
"We're coming, my lady! Praise God and plead, sweet Jesus, we'll be in time! We're coming!"
She began to pull half-healed turves out of the ground with her trembling fingers, and although Geoffrey returned in almost no time, she had by then already clawed a hole some 8 inches deep. He was already 9 pages into chapter 7. Geoffrey and Mrs. Ramage had managed to get Misery out of her grave, and in the barest nick of time only to realize that the woman had no idea at all who they were, or who she herself was, when Annie came into the room. This time Paul heard her. He stopped typing, sorry to be out of the dream. She held the first 6 chapters at the side of her skirt. It had taken her less than 20 minutes to read his first stab at it. It had been an hour since she had taken this sheaf of 21 pages. He looked at her steadily, observing with faint interest that Annie Wilkes was a bit pale. "Well," he asked, "is it fair?"
"Yes,"
she said absently, as if this was a foregone conclusion, and Paul supposed it was.
"It's fair, and it's good, exciting, but it's gruesome, too. It's not like any of the other misery books. That poor woman who scraped the ends of her fingers off."
She shook her head and repeated,
"It's not like any of the other misery books."
"The man who wrote these pages was in a rather gruesome frame of mind, my dear," Paul thought. "Shall I go on?" he asked.
"I'll kill you if you don't,"
she responded, smiling a little. Paul didn't smile back. This comment, which would once have struck him as in a league with such banalities as,
"You look so good I could just eat you up,"
now seemed not banal at all. Yet something in her attitude as she stood in the doorway fascinated him. It was as if she was a little frightened to come any closer, as if she thought something in him might burn her. It wasn't the subject of premature burial that had done it, and he was wise enough to know it. No, it was the difference between his first try and this one. That first one had had all the life of an 8th grader's "How I Spent My Summer Vacation" theme. This one was different. The furnace was on. Oh, not that he had written particularly well. The story was hot, but the characters as stereotyped and predictable as ever. But this time he had been able to at least generate some power. This time there was heat baking out from between the lines. Amused, he thought, she felt the heat. I think she's afraid to get too close in case I might burn her. Well, he said mildly, you won't have to kill me, Annie. I want to go on. So why don't I get at it? All right, she said. She brought the pages to him, put them on the board, and then stepped back quickly. Would you like to read it as I go along? He asked. Annie smiled. Yes. It would be almost like the chapter plays when I was a kid. Well, I can't promise a cliffhanger at the end of every chapter, he said. It just doesn't work that way. It will for me, she said fervently. I want to know what was going to happen in chapter 18, even if 17 ended with Misery and Ian and Jeffrey sitting in armchairs on the porch reading newspapers. I'm already wild to know what's going to happen next. Don't tell me, she added sharply, as if Paul had offered to do this. Well, I generally don't show my work until it's all done, he said, and then smiled at her. But since this is a special situation, I'll be happy to let you read it chapter by chapter. And so began the 1001 Nights of Paul Sheldon, he thought. But I wonder if you'd do something for me.
What?
Fill in these damned ends, he said. She smiled at him radiantly.
It'd be an honor. I'll leave you alone now.
She went back to the door, hesitated there, and turned back. Then, with a deep and almost painful timidity, she offered the only editorial suggestion she ever made to him.
Maybe it was a bee.
He had already dropped his gaze to the sheet of paper in the typewriter. He was looking for the hole. He wanted to get Misery back to Mrs. Ramage's cottage before he knocked off, and he looked back up at Annie with carefully disguised impatience. I beg pardon?
A bee, she said.
And he saw a blush creeping up her neck and over her cheeks. Soon even her ears were glowing.
One person in every dozen is allergic to bee venom. I saw lots of cases of it before I retired from service as an RN. The allergy can show in a lot of different ways. Sometimes a sting can cause a comatose condition, which is similar to what people used to call, catalepsy.
Now she was so red she was almost purple. Paul held the idea up briefly in his mind and then tossed it on the scrap heap. A bee could have been the cause of Miss Evelyn Hyde's unfortunate live burial. It even made sense, since it had happened in mid-spring, in the garden to boot. But he had already decided that credibility depended on the two live burials being related somehow, and Misery had succumbed in her bedroom. The fact that late fall was hardly bee season was not really the problem. The problem was the rarity of the cataleptic reaction. He thought Constant Reader would not swallow two unrelated women in neighboring townships being buried alive 6 months apart as a result of bee stings. Yet he could not tell Annie that, and not just because it might rile her up. He could not tell her because it would hurt her badly, and in spite of all the pain she had afforded him, he found he could not hurt her in that way. He had been hurt that way himself. He fell back on that most common writer's workshop euphemism. It's got possibilities, all right. I'll drop it into the hopper, Annie. I've already got some ideas in mind. It may not fit.
Oh, I know that. You're the writer, not me. Just forget I said anything. I'm sorry.
Don't be... But she was gone, her heavy tread almost running down the hallway to the parlor. He was looking at an empty space. His eyes dropped, then widened. On either side of the doorway, about 8 inches up from the floor, was a black mark. They had been left, he understood at once, by the hubs of his wheelchair when he forced it through. So far, she hadn't noticed them. It had been almost a week, and her failure to notice was a small miracle. But soon, tomorrow, perhaps even this afternoon, she would be into vacuum, and then she would. She would. Paul managed very little during the rest of the day. The hole in the paper had disappeared. following morning, Paul was sitting up in bed, propped on a pile of pillows, drinking a cup of coffee and eyeing those marks on the sides of the door with the guilty eye of a murderer who has just seen some bloody item of clothing of which he has somehow neglected to dispose. Suddenly, Annie came rushing into the room, her eyes wide and bulging. She held a dustcloth in one hand. In the other, incredibly, she held a pair of handcuffs. What? It was all he had time for. She seized him with panicky strength and pulled him into an upright sitting position. Pain, the worst in days, bellowed through his legs, and he screamed. The coffee cup flew out of his hand and shattered on the floor. Things keep breaking in here, he thought. And then she saw the marks. Of course. Probably a long time ago. That was the only way he could have kept bizarre behavior. She had seen the marks after all, and this was the beginning of some new and spectacular punishment.
Shut up, stupid!
She hissed. And then his hands were pinned behind him, and just as he heard the click of the handcuffs, he also heard a car turning into the driveway. He opened his mouth, meaning to speak or perhaps scream again, and she stuffed the rag into it before he could do either. There was some ghastly dead taste on the rag. Pledge, he supposed, or end dust, or something like that.
Make no sound, she said, leaning over him with one hand on either side of his head, strands of her hair tickling his cheeks and forehead. I warn you, Paul, if whoever that is hears something, or even if I hear something and think he might have heard something, I will kill him or them, then you, then myself.
She stood up. Her eyes were bulging. There was sweat on her face and dried egg yolk on her lips.
Remember, Paul.
He was nodding, but she didn't see. She was already running out. An old but well-preserved Chevy Bel Air had pulled up behind Annie's Cherokee. Paul heard a door open somewhere off the parlor and then bang shut. It gave off the oddly interrogative squeak that told him it was the closet where she kept her outdoor stuff. The man getting out of the car was as old and well-preserved as the car itself, a Colorado type, if ever Paul had seen one. He looked 65, but might be 80. He might be the senior partner of a law firm, or the semi-retired patriarch of a construction company, but was more likely a rancher or a realtor. He would be a Republican of the sort who would no more put a bumper sticker on his car than he would put a pair of pointy-toed Italian shoes on his feet. He must also be some sort of town official, and here on town business, because it was only on town business that a man like this and a reclusive woman like Annie Wilkes would have occasion to meet. Paul watched her hasten down the walk to the driveway, intent not on meeting but intercepting him. Here was something much like his earlier fantasy come true. Not a cop, but someone in authority. Authority had arrived at Annie's, and its arrival here could do nothing but shorten his own life. Why not invite him in, Annie? He thought, trying not to choke on the dusty rag. Why not invite him in and your African bird? Oh, no. She would no more invite Mr. Rocky Mountain businessman in than she would drive Paul to Stapleton International and put a first-class ticket back to New York in his hand. She was talking even before she reached him, the breath pluming out of her mouth in shapes like cartoon balloons with no words written inside them. He held out a hand dressed in a narrowly elegant black leather glove. She looked at it briefly, contemptuously, then began to shake a finger in his face, more of those empty white balloons puffing from her mouth. She finished struggling into her coat and stopped shaking her finger long enough to rake the zipper up. He reached into the pocket of his topcoat and brought out a sheet of paper. He held it out to her almost apologetically. Although Paul had no way of knowing exactly what it was, he was sure that Annie had an adjective for it. Cockadoodie, maybe. She led him along the driveway, still talking. They passed beyond his sight line. He could see their shadows lying like construction paper cutouts on the snow, but that was all. She had done it on purpose, he realized dully. If he, Paul, couldn't see them, then there was no chance that Mr. Rancho Grande might look in through the guest room window and see him. The shadows remained on the melting snowpack of Annie's driveway for about 5 minutes. Once Paul actually heard Annie's voice, raised in an angry, hectoring shout. Those were a long 5 minutes for Paul. His shoulders ached. He found he couldn't move to ease the ache. After cuffing his hands together, She had somehow bound them to the bedstead. But the dustcloth in his mouth was the worst. The stink of the furniture polish was making his head ache, and he was growing steadily more nauseated. He concentrated grimly on controlling it. He had no interest in choking to death, his windpipe full of vomit, while Annie argued with an elderly town official who got his hair trimmed once a week at a local tonsorial emporium and probably wore rubbers over his black Oxfords all winter long. Cold, sick sweat had broken on his forehead by the time they reappeared. Now Annie was holding the paper. She followed Mr. Rancho Grande, shaking her finger at his back, those empty cartoon balloons issuing from her mouth. Mr. Rancho Grande would not look around at her. His face was carefully blank. Only his lips, pressed together so tightly that they almost disappeared, gave away some inward emotion. Anger? Perhaps. Distaste? Yes. That was probably closer. You think she's crazy. You and all your poker cronies. Probably control this whole minor league ballpark of a town. Probably played a hand of lowball or something to see who got this shit detail. No one likes to bring bad news to crazy people. But oh, Mr. Rancho Grande, if you knew just how crazy she really is, I don't think you'd turn your back on her like that. He got into the Bel Air. He closed the door. Now she stood beside the car, shaking her finger at his closed window. And again Paul could dimly hear her voice.
Think you are so smart.
The Bel Air began to back slowly down the driveway. Mr. Rancho Grande was ostentatiously not looking at Annie, whose teeth were bared. Louder still.
You think you are such a great big wheel.
Suddenly she kicked the front bumper of Mr. Rancho Grande's car, kicked it hard enough to knock packed chunks of snow out of the wheel wells. The old guy had been looking over his right shoulder, guiding the car down the driveway. Now he looked back at her, startled out of the careful neutrality he had maintained all through his visit.
Well, I'll tell you something, you dirty bird. Little dogs go to the bathroom all over big wheels. What do you think of that, huh?
Whatever he thought of it, Mr. Rancho Grande was not going to give Annie the satisfaction of seeing it. That neutral expression dropped over his face again like the visor on a suit of armor. He backed out of Paul's sight. She stood there for a moment, hands fisted on hips, then stalked back toward the house. He heard the kitchen door open and explode shut. Well, he's gone, Paul thought. Mr. Rancho Grande is gone, but I'm here. Oh, yes, I'm here. But this time she didn't take her anger out on him. She came into his room, her coat still on, but now unzipped. She began to pace rapidly back and forth, not even looking his way. The piece of paper was still in her hand, and every now and then she would shake it in front of her own nose, as if in self-chastisement.
10% tax increase, he says. In arrears, he says. Liens, lawyers. Quarterly payment, he says. Overdue. Cock-a-doody. Cock-a. Cock-a-poopy-doopy.
He grunted into the rag, but she didn't look around. She was in a room by herself. She walked back and forth faster, cutting the air with her solid body. He kept thinking she would tear the paper to shreds, but it seemed she did not quite dare do this.
$506,
she cried, this time brandishing the paper in front of his nose. She absently tore the rag that was choking him out of his mouth and threw it on the floor. He hung his head over to one side, dry heaving. His arms felt as if they were slowly detaching themselves from their sockets.
$506.17. They know I don't want anyone out here. I told them, didn't I? And look, look!
He dry-heaved again, making a desperate burping sound.
If you vomit, I guess you'll just have to lie in it. Looks like I've got other fish to fry. He said something about a lien on my house. What's that?
Handcuffs, he croaked.
Yes, yes, she said impatiently. Sometimes you're such a baby.
She pulled the key from her skirt pocket and pushed him even farther to the left, so that his nose pressed the sheets. He screamed, but she ignored him. There was a click, a rattle, and then his hands were free. He sat up gasping, then slid slowly down against his pillows, mindful to push his legs straight ahead as he did. There were pale furrows in his thin wrists. As he watched, they began to fill in red. Annie stuffed the cups absently into her skirt pocket, as if police restraints were found in most decent houses, like Kleenex or coat hangers.
"What's a lien?" she asked again. "Does that mean they own my house? Is that what it means?"
"No," he said. "It means that you..." He cleared his throat and got another aftertaste of that fumy dust rag. His chest hitched as he dry-heaved again. She took no notice of that, simply stood impatiently staring at him until he could talk. After a while, he could.
"Just means you can't sell it." "Just? Just? You got a funny idea of just, Mr. Paul Sheldon. But I suppose the troubles of a poor widow like me don't seem very important to a rich Mr. Smart Guy like you."
"On the contrary, I think of your troubles as my troubles, Annie. I just mean that a lien isn't much compared to what they could do if you got seriously in arrears. Are you?"
"Arrears? That means in the bucket, doesn't it?"
"In the bucket, in the hole, behind, yes."
"I'm no shanty Irish moocher."
He saw the thin sheen of her teeth as her upper lip lifted.
"I pay my bills. I just... this time I just..."
"You forgot, didn't you? You forgot. Just the way you keep forgetting to change February on that damn calendar. Forgetting to make the quarterly property tax payment is a hell of a lot more serious than forgetting to change the calendar page. And you're upset because this is the first time you forgot something that big. Fact is, you're getting worse, Annie, aren't you? A little worse every day. Psychotics can cope in the world after a fashion, and sometimes, as I think you well know, they get away with some very nasty shit. But there's a borderline between the lands of manageable and unmanageable psychosis. You're getting closer to that line every day, and part of you knows it."
"I just hadn't gotten around to it yet,"
Annie said sullenly.
"Having you here has kept me busier than a one-armed paper hanger."
An idea occurred to him, a really fine one. The potential for brownie points in this idea seemed almost unlimited. "I know," he said with quiet sincerity. "I owe you my life, and I haven't been anything but a pain in the tail to you. I've got about $400 in my wallet. I want you to pay your arrears with it."
"Oh, Paul."
She was looking at him, both confused and pleased.
"I couldn't take your money."
"It's not mine," he said. He grinned at her, his number one "who loves you, baby" grin. And inside he thought, "What I want, Annie, is for you to do one of your forgetting acts when I've got access to one of your knives, and I'm sure I can move well enough to use it. You'll be frying in hell 10 seconds before you know you're dead. It's yours. Call it a down payment if you want." He paused, then took a calculated risk. "If you don't think I know I'd be dead if it wasn't for you, you're crazy."
"Paul, I don't know. I'm serious."
He allowed his smile to melt into an expression of winning, or so he hoped. Please, God, let it be winning. Sincerity. "You did more than save my life, you know. You saved 2 lives. Because without you, Misery would still be lying in her grave." Now she was looking at him shiningly, the paper in her hand forgotten. "And you showed me the error of my ways, got me back on track again. I owe you a lot more than $400 just for that. And if you don't take that money, you're going to make me feel bad."
"Well, I... all right, I... thank you."
"I should be thanking you. May I see that paper?" She gave it to him with no protest at all. It was an overdue tax notice. The lien was little more than a formality. He scanned it quickly, then handed it back. "Have you got money in the bank?" Her eyes shifted away from his.
"I've got a little put aside, but not in the bank. I don't believe in banks."
This says they can't execute the lien on you unless the bill remains unpaid by March 25th. What's today? She frowned at the calendar.
Goodness, that's wrong.
She untacked it, and the boy on his sled disappeared. Paul watched this happen with an absurd pang of regret. March showed a whitewater stream rushing pell-mell between snowy banks. She peered myopically at the calendar for a moment, and then said,
"Today is March 25th.
Christ, so late, so late," he thought.
"Sure, that's why he came out."
"He wasn't telling you they had slapped a lien on your house, Annie. He was telling you they would have to if you didn't cough up by the time the town offices closed tonight. Guy was actually trying to do you a favor. But if you pay this $506 before..."
"And 17 cents," she put in fiercely. "Don't forget the cock-a-doodle 17 cents.
"All right, and 17 cents. If you pay it before they close down the town offices this afternoon, no lien. If people in town really feel about you the way you say they do, Annie..."
"They hate me. They're all against me, Paul."
"Then your taxes are one of the ways they'll try to pry you out. Hollering lien at someone who has missed one quarterly property payment is pretty weird. It smells. Well, it stinks. If you missed a couple of quarterly payments, they might try to take your home, sell it at auction. It's a crazy idea, but I guess they're technically within their rights." She laughed, a harsh barking sound.
"Let them try. I'd gut hole a few of them, I'll tell you that much. Yes, sir, yes, siree, Bob."
"In the end, they'll gut hole you," he said quietly. "But that isn't the point."
"Then what is?"
"Annie, there are probably people in Sidewinder who are 2 or 3 years behind on their taxes. No one is taking their homes or auctioning their furnishings down at the town hall. The worst that happens to people like that most of the time is that they lose their town water. The Roydmans now." He looked at her shrewdly. "You think they pay their taxes on time?"
"That white trash?"
she nearly shrieked.
"Ha!"
"I think they're on the prod for you, Annie." He did, in fact, believe this.
"I'll never go. I'll stay up here just to spite them. I'll stay up here and spit in their eye."
"Can you come up with $106 to go with the $400 in my wallet?"
"Yes."
She was beginning to look cautiously relieved. "Good enough," he said. "Then I suggest you pay their crappy tax bill today. And while you're gone, I'll see what I can do about those damn marks on the door. And when that's done, I believe I'll see if I can do anything about getting the fuck out of here, Annie. I'm a little tired of your hospitality." He managed to smile. "I think there must be at least 17 cents there in the night table," he said. Annie Wilkes had her own interior set of rules. In her way, she was strangely prim. She had made him drink water from a floor bucket, had withheld his medication until he was in agony, had made him burn the only copy of his new novel, had handcuffed him and stuck a rag reeking of furniture polish in his mouth. But she would not take money from his wallet. She brought it to him, the old scuffed Lord Buxton he'd had since college, and put it in his hands. All the ID had, at that, she had not scrupled. He did not ask her about it. It seemed wiser not to. The ID was gone, but the money was still there. The bills, mostly 50s, crisp and fresh. With a clarity that was both surprising and somehow ominous, he saw himself pulling the Camaro up to the drive-in window of the Boulder Bank the day before he had finished Fast Cars, and dropping his check for $450, made out to cash and endorsed on the back, into the tray. Perhaps even then the guys in the sweatshops had been talking vacation. He thought it likely. The man who had done that had been free and healthy and feeling good, and had been without the wit to appreciate any of those fine things. The man who had done that had eyed the drive-up teller with a lively, interested eye. Tall, blonde, wearing a purple dress that had cupped her curves with a lover's touch. And she had eyed him back. What would she think, he wondered, of that man as he looked now, 40 pounds lighter and 10 years older, his legs a pair of crooked, useless horrors?
"Paul?"
He looked up at her, holding the money in one hand. There was 420 in all. Yes? She was looking at him with that disconcerting expression of maternal love and tenderness, disconcerting because of the total solid blackness underlying it. Are you crying, Paul? He brushed his cheek with his free hand, and yes, there was moisture there. He smiled and handed her the money. A little. I was thinking how good you've been to me. Oh, I suppose a lot of people wouldn't understand. But I think I know. Her own eyes glistened as she leaned forward and gently touched his lips. He smelled something on her breath, something from the dark and sour chambers inside her, something that smelled like dead fish. It was 1,000 times worse than the taste smell of the dust rag. It brought back the memory of her sour breath.
Breathe, goddammit! Breathe!
Blowing down his throat like a dirty wind from hell. His stomach clenched, but he smiled at her.
I love you, dear, she said.
Would you put me in my chair before you go? I want to write.
Of course, she hugged him. Of course, my dear.
Her tenderness did not extend to leaving the bedroom door unlocked, but this presented no problem. He was not half mad with pain and withdrawal symptoms this time. He had collected 4 of her bobby pins as assiduously as a squirrel collects nuts for the winter, and he had secreted them under his mattress along with the pills. When he was sure she was really gone and not hanging around to see if he was going to get up to dittos, another Wilkesism for his growing lexicon, he rolled the wheelchair over to the bed and got the pins, along with a pitcher of water and the box of Kleenex from the night table. Rolling the wheelchair with a royal perched on the board of the front of him was not very difficult. His arms had gotten a lot stronger. Annie Wilkes might be surprised to know just how strong they were now, and he sincerely hoped that someday soon she would be. The royal typewriter made a shitty writing machine, but as an exercise tool it was great. He had begun lifting it and setting it down whenever he was pinned in the chair behind it, and she was out of the room. 5 lifts of 6 inches or so had been the best he could manage at first. Now he could do 18 or 20 without a pause. Not bad when you considered the bastard weighed at least 50 pounds. He worked on the lock with one of the bobby pins, holding 2 spares in his mouth like a seamstress hemming a dress. He thought that the piece of bobby pin still somewhere inside the lock might screw him up, but it didn't. He caught the rocker almost at once and pushed it up, drawing the lock's tongue along with it. He had just a moment to wonder if she might not have put a bolt on the outside of the door as well. He had tried very hard to seem weaker and sicker than he now really felt, but the suspicions of the true paranoiac spread wide and run deep. Then the door was open. He felt the same nervous guilt, the urge to do this fast. Ears attuned for the sound of old Bessie returning, although she'd only been gone 45 minutes. He pulled a bunch of the Kleenex, dipped the wad in the pitcher, and bent awkwardly over to one side with a soppy mass in his hand. Gritting his teeth and ignoring the pain, he began to rub at the mark on the right-hand side of the door. To his intense relief, it began to fade almost at once. The hubs of the wheelchair had not actually scored through the paint as he had feared, but only scuffed it. He reversed away from the door, turned the chair, and backed up so he could work on the other mark. When he had done all he could, he reversed again and looked at the door, trying to see it through Annie's exquisitely suspicious eyes. The marks were there, but faint, almost unnoticeable. He thought he would be okay. He hoped he would be okay. Tornado cellars, he said, licked his lips and laughed dryly. What the fuck, friends and neighbors? He rolled back to the door and looked out at the corridor. But now that the marks were gone, he felt no urge to go farther or dare more today. Another day, yes. He would know that day when it came around. What he wanted to do now was right. He closed the door, and the click of the lock seemed very loud. Africa. That bird came from Africa. But you mustn't cry for that bird, Polly, because after a while it forgot about how the veldt smelled at noonday, and the sounds of the wildebeests at the waterhole, and the high acidic smell of the yucca trees in the great clearing north of the big road. After a while it forgot the cerise color of the sun dying behind Kilimanjaro. After a while it only knew the muddy, smogged-out sunsets of Boston. That was all it remembered, and all it wanted to remember. After a while it didn't want to go back anymore. And if someone took it back and set it free, it would only crouch in one place, afraid and hurting and homesick in two unknown and terribly ineluctable directions, until something came along and killed it. Oh, Africa. Oh, shit, he said in a trembling voice. Crying a little, he rolled the wheelchair over to the wastebasket and buried the wet wads of Kleenex under the waste paper. He repositioned the wheelchair by the window and rolled a piece of paper into the Royal. And by the way, Polly, is the bumper sticker of your car sticking out of the snow yet? Is it sticking out, twinkling cheerily in the sun, just waiting for someone to come along and see it, while you sit here wasting what may be your last chance? He looked doubtfully at the blank sheet of paper in the typewriter. I won't be able to write now anyway. That spoiled it. But nothing had ever spoiled it somehow. It could be spoiled, he knew that. But in spite of the reputed fragility of the creative act, it had always been the single toughest thing, the most abiding thing in his life. Nothing had ever been able to pollute that crazy well of dreams. No drink, no drug, no pain. He fled to that well now, like a thirsty animal finding a waterhole at dusk, and he drank from it. Which is to say, he found the hole in the paper and fell thankfully through it. By the time Annie got back home at 6:15, he had done almost 5 pages. During the next 3 weeks, Paul Sheldon felt surrounded by a queer electric peacefulness. His mouth was always dry. Sound seemed too loud. There were days when he felt he could bend spoons simply by looking at them. Other days he felt like weeping hysterically. Outside this, separate of the atmosphere and apart from the deep, maddening itch of his healing legs, its own serene thing, the work continued. The stack of pages to the right of the Royal grew steadily taller. Before this strange experience, he had considered 4 pages a day to bars it had usually been 3, and only 2 on many days, before the final finishing sprint. But during this electric 3-week period, which came to an end with a rainstorm of April 15th, Paul averaged 12 pages a day, 7 in the morning, 5 more in an evening session. If anyone in his previous life, for so he had come to think of it, without even realizing it, had suggested he could work at such a pace, Paul would have laughed. When the rain began to fall, he had 267 pages of Misery's Return. First draft stuff, sure, but he had scanned through it and thought it amazingly clean for a first. Part of the reason was that he was living an amazingly straight life. No long, muddled nights spent bar hopping, followed by long, muddled days spent drinking coffee and orange juice and gobbling vitamin B tablets. Days when, if his glance so much as happened upon his typewriter, he would turn away, shuddering. No more waking up next to a big blonde or redhead he had picked up somewhere the night before. A lass who usually looked like a queen at midnight and a goblin at 10 the next morning. No more cigarettes. He had once asked for them in a timid and tentative voice, and she had given him a look of such utter darkness that he had told her at once to forget it. He was Mr. Clean. No bad habits, except for his codeine, Jones, of course. Still haven't done anything about that, have we, Paul? No distractions. Here I am, the world's only monastic druggie. Up at 7. Down 2 Norville with juice. At 8 o'clock, breakfast came, served at Monsieur's bedside. A single egg, poached or scrambled, 3 days a week. High-fiber cereal the other 4 days. Then into the wheelchair. Over to the window. Find the hole in the paper. Fall into the 19th century, where men were men and women wore bustles. Lunch. Afternoon nap. Up again, sometimes to edit, sometimes just to read. She had everything Somerset Maugham had ever written. Once Paul found himself wondering dourly if she had John Fowle's first novel on her shelves, and decided it might be better not to ask. And Paul began to work his way through the 20-odd volumes that comprised Mom's oeuvre, fascinated by the man's canny grasp of story values. Over the years, Paul had grown more and more resigned to the fact that he could not read stories as he had when he was a kid. By becoming a writer of them himself, he had condemned himself to a life of dissection. But Mom first seduced him, and then made him a child again. And that was wonderful. At 5 o'clock, she would serve him a light supper, and at 7, she would roll in the black-and-white television, and they would watch MASH and WKRP in Cincinnati. When these were over, Paul would write. When he was done, he would roll the wheelchair slowly. He could have gone much faster, but it was just as well that Annie should not know that. Over to the bed. She would hear, come in, and help him back into bed. More medication. Boom. Out like a light. And the next day would be just the same. And the next. And the next. Being such a straight arrow was part of the reason for this amazing fecundity. But Annie herself was a bigger one. After all, it was her single hesitant suggestion about the bee sting which had shaped the book and given it its urgency, when Paul had firmly believed he could never feel urgent about misery again. He'd been sure of one thing from the start. There really was no misery's return. His attention had been focused only on finding a way to get the bitch out of her grave without cheating, before Annie decided to inspire him by giving him an enema with a handful of Jinsu knives. Minor matters, such as what the fucking book was supposed to be about, would have to wait. During the 2 days following Annie's trip to town to pay her tax bill, Paul tried to forget his failure to take advantage of what could have been a golden opportunity to escape, and concentrated on getting Misery back to Mrs. Ramage's cottage instead. Taking her to Jeffrey's home was no good. The servants, most notably Jeffrey's gossipy butler, Tyler, would see and talk. Also, he needed to establish the total amnesia which had been caused by the shock of being buried alive. Amnesia? Shit, the chick could barely talk. Sort of a relief, given Misery's usual burblings. So, what next? The bitch was out of her grave. Now where was the fucking story? Should Jeffrey and Mrs. Ramage tell Ian that Misery was still alive? Paul didn't think so, but he wasn't sure. Not being sure of things he knew was a charmless corner of purgatory reserved for writers, who were driving fast with no idea at all where they were going. Not Ian, he thought, looking out at the barn. Not Ian, not yet. The doctor first. That old asshole with all the N's in his name. Scheinbaum. The thought of the doctor brought Annie's comment about the bee stings to mind, and not for the first time. It kept recurring at odd moments. One person in every dozen. But it just wouldn't play. Two unrelated women in neighboring townships, both allergic to stings in the same rare way. 3 days following the great Annie Wilkes tax bailout, Paul had been drowsing his way into his afternoon nap when the guys in the sweatshop weighed in, and weighed in heavy. This time it wasn't a flare. This time it was an H-bomb explosion. He sat bolt upright in bed, ignoring the flare of pain which shot up his legs. Annie, he bawled. Annie, come in here. He heard her thump down the stairs two at a time and then run down the hallway. Her eyes were wide and scared when she came in. Paul, what's wrong? Are you cramping? Are you... No, he said, but of course he was. His mind was cramping. No, Annie, I'm sorry if I scared you, but you gotta help me into the chair. Mighty fuck, I got it. The dreaded F-word was out before he could help it, but this time it didn't seem to matter. She was looking at him respectfully, and with not a little awe. Here was the secular version of the Pentecostal fire, burning before her very eyes. Of course, Paul. She got him into the chair as quickly as she could. She began to roll him toward the window, and Paul shook his head impatiently. This won't take long, he said, but it's very important. Is it about the book? It is the book. Be quiet. Don't talk to me. Ignoring the typewriter, he never used the typewriter to make notes. He seized one of the ballpoints and quickly covered a single sheet of paper with a scrawl that probably no one but himself could have read. They were related. It was bees, and it affected them both the same way because they were related. Misery's an orph. And guess what? The Evelyn Hyde babe was Misery's sister. Or maybe half-sister. That would probably work better. Who gets the first hint? Shinny? No, Shinny's a ninny. Mrs. R. She can go see Charles E.H.'s mommy and... And now he was struck by an idea of such intense loveliness, in terms of the plot at least, that he looked up, mouth open, eyes wide. "Pa?" Annie asked anxiously.
"She knew,"
Paul whispered.
"Of course she did. At least strongly suspected, but..."
He bent to his notes again. "She, Mrs. R., realizes at once that Mrs. E.H. has got to know M is related to her dot. Same hair or something. Remember, E.H.'s mom is starting to look like a mage character. You'll need to work her up. Mrs. R. starts to realize Mrs. E.H. may even have known Misery was buried alive. Shit on a shingle, love it. Suppose the old lady guessed Misery was a leftover of her fuck 'em and leave 'em days and..." He put the pen down, looked at the paper, then slowly picked up the pen again and scrawled a few more lines. Three necessary points. One, how does Mrs. E.H. react to Mrs. R.'s suspicions? She should be either murderous or puked up scared. I prefer scared, but think A.W. would like murderous, so okay, murd. Two, how does... Three, Zemnir's one agree. Does Misery find out her mom lived with the possibility that not just one, but two of her daughters had been buried alive rather than speak up? Why not? You could help me back into bed now if you wanted, Paul said. I was just excited. That's all right, Paul. She still sounded awed. Since then, the work had driven on famously. Annie was right. The story was turning out to be a good deal more gruesome than the other Misery books. The first chapter had not been a fluke, but a harbinger. But it was also more richly plotted than any Misery novel since the first, and the characters were more lively. The latter three Misery novels had been little more than straightforward adventure tales, with a fair amount of piquantly described sex thrown in to please the ladies. This book, he began to understand, was a gothic novel, and thus was more dependent on plot than on situation. The challenges were constant. It was not just a question of can you to begin the book. For the first time in years, it was can you almost every day, and he was finding he could. Then the rain came and things changed. From the 8th of April until the 14th, they enjoyed an unbroken run of fine weather. The sun beamed down from a cloudless sky, and the temperatures sometimes rose into the mid-60s. Brown patches began to appear in the field behind Annie's knee. He hid behind his work not to think about his car, the discovery of which was already over. His work did not. His mood did. He felt more and more that he was living in a cloud chamber, bringing an atmosphere thick with uncoalesced electricity. Whenever the Camaro stole into his mind, he immediately called the brain police and had the thought led away in handcuffs and leg irons. Trouble was, the nasty thing had a way of escaping and coming back time after time, in one form or another. One night he dreamed that Mr. Rancho Grande returned to Annie's place. He got out of his well-kept Chevrolet Bel Air, holding part of the Camaro's bumper in one hand and its steering wheel in the other. "Do these belong to you?" he asked Annie in his dream. Paul had awakened in a less than cheery frame of mind. Annie, on the other hand, had never been in better spirits than she was during that sunny early spring week. She cleaned. She cooked ambitious meals, although everything she cooked came out tasting strangely industrial, as if years of eating in hospital cafeterias had somehow corrupted any culinary talent she might once have had. Each afternoon she bundled Paul up in a huge blue blanket, jammed a green hunting cap on his head, and rolled him out onto the back porch. On those occasions he would take Mom along, but rarely read him. Being outside again was too great an experience to allow much concentration on other things. Mostly he just sat, smelling the sweet, cool air instead of the bedroom's stale indoor smell, sly with sickroom undertones, listened to the drip of the icicles, and watched the cloud shadows roll slowly and steadily across the melting field. That was somehow best of all. Annie sang in her unpitched but queerly tuneless voice. She giggled like a child at the jokes on MASH and WKRP, laughing especially hard at the jokes which were mildly off-color, which in the case of WKRP was most of them. She filled in ends tirelessly as Paul finished chapters 9 and 10. The morning of the 15th dawned windy and dull with clouds, and Annie changed. Perhaps Paul thought it was the falling barometer. It was as good an explanation as any. She did not show up with his medication until 9 o'clock, and by then he needed it quite badly, so badly that he had been thinking of going to his stash. There was no breakfast, just the pills. When she came in, she was still in her pink quilted housecoat. He noted with deep misgivings that there were red marks like wheels on her cheeks and arms. He also saw gooey splatters of food on the housecoat, and she had only managed to get on one of her slippers. Thud slush went Annie's feet as she approached him. Thud slush, thud slush, thud slush. Her hair hung around her face. Her eyes were dull. Here. She threw the pills at him. Her hands were also covered with mixed streaks of goo. Red stuff, brown stuff, sticky white stuff. Paul had no idea what it was. He wasn't sure he wanted to know. The pills hit his chest and bounced into his lap. She turned to go. Thud slush, thud slush, thud slush. Annie? She stopped, not turning around. She looked bigger that way, with her shoulders rounding the pink housecoat, her hair like some battered helmet. She looked like a Piltdown woman staring out of her cave. Annie, are you all right? No, she said indifferently, and turned around. She looked at him with that same dullard's expression as she pinched her lower lip between the thumb and first finger of her right hand. She pulled it out and then twisted it, pinching inward at the same time. Blood first welled between lip and gum, then gushed down her chin. She turned and left without speaking a word, before his stunned mind could persuade itself that he had really seen her do that. She closed the door and locked it. He heard her thud slushing her way down the hall to the parlor. He heard the creak of her favorite chair as she sat down. Nothing else. No TV, no singing, no click-clink of silver or crockery. No, she was just sitting there being not all right. Then there was a sound. It was not repeated, but it was utterly distinctive. It was a slap, a damned hard one. And since he was in here on one side of a locked door, and she was out there on the other side of it, didn't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out that she'd slapped herself. Good and hard from the sound. He saw her pulling her lip out, digging her short nails into her sensitive pink meat. He suddenly remembered a note on mental illness he had taken for the first misery book, where much of the action had been set in London's Bedlam Hospital. Misery had been railroaded there by the madly jealous villainess. When a manic depressive personality begins to slide deeply into a depressive period, he had written, one symptom he or she may exhibit is acts of self-punishment. Slapping, punching, pinching, burning oneself with cigarette butts, etc. He was suddenly very scared. Paul remembered an essay by Edmund Wilson, where Wilson had said, in typically grudging Wilson manner, that Wordsworth's criterion for the writing of good poetry, strong emotion recalled in a time of tranquility, would do well enough for most dramatic fiction as well. It was probably true. Paul had known writers who found it impossible to write after so much as a minor marital spat, and he himself usually found it impossible to write when upset. But there were times when a kind of reverse effect obtained. These were times when he had gone to the work not just because the work ought to be done, but because it was a way to escape whatever was upsetting him. These were usually occasions when rectifying the source of the upset was beyond him. This was one of those occasions. When she still hadn't returned to put him in his chair by 11 that morning, he determined to get into it by himself. Getting the typewriter off the mantel would be beyond him, but he could write longhand. He was sure he could hoist himself into the chair, knew it was probably a bad idea to let Annie know he could. But he needed his other fix, goddammit, and he could not write lying here in bed. He worked himself over to the edge of the bed, made sure the wheelchair brake was on, then grasped its arms and pulled himself slowly into the seat. Pulling his legs up onto the supports one at a time was the only part that hurt. He rolled himself over to the window and picked up his manuscript. The key rattled in the lock. Annie was looking in at him. Her eyes burned black holes in her face. Her right cheek was swelling up, and it looked like she was going to have a hell of a shiner in the morning. There was red stuff around her mouth and on her chin. For a moment, Paul thought it was more blood from her torn lip, and then he saw the seeds in it. It was raspberry jam or raspberry filling, not blood. She looked at him. Paul looked back. Neither said anything for a time. Outside, the first drops of rain splattered against the window.
"If you can get into that chair all by yourself, Paul," she said at last, "then I think you can fill in your own fucking ends."
She then closed the door and locked it again. Paul sat looking at it for a long time, almost as if there was something to see. He was too flabbergasted to do anything else. He didn't see her again until late afternoon. After her visit, work was impossible. He made a couple of futile tries, wadded up the paper, and gave up. It was a bust. He rolled himself back across the room. In the process of getting out of the chair and into bed, one of his hands slipped and he came within an ace of falling. He brought his left leg down, and although it took his weight and saved him from the fall, the pain was excruciating. It felt as if a dozen bolts had suddenly been driven into the bone. He screamed, scrabbled for the headboard, and pulled himself safely over onto the bed, his throbbing left leg trailing behind the rest of him. "That will bring her," he thought incoherently. "She'll want to see if Sheldon really turned into Luciano Pavarotti, or if it just sounds that way." But she didn't come, and there was no way he could bear the rotted ache in his left leg. He rolled clumsily onto his stomach, burrowed one arm deep under the mattress, and brought out one of the Novril sample cards. He dry-swallowed two, then drifted for a while. When he came back, he thought at first he must still be dreaming. It was just too surreal, like the night when she rolled the barbecue pot in here. Annie was sitting on the side of his bed. She had set a water glass filled with Novril capsules on his bed table. In her other hand, she had a Victor rat trap. There was a rat in it, too. A large one with mottled gray-brown fur. The trap had broken the rat's back. Its rear feet hung over the sides of the trap's board, twitching randomly. There were beads of blood in its whiskers. This was no dream. Just another day lost in the funhouse with Annie. Her breath smelled like a corpse decomposing in rotted food. "Annie?" He straightened up, his eyes moving between her and the rat. Outside it was dusk, a strange blue dusk filled with rain. It sheeted against the window. Strong gusts of wind shook the house, making it creak. Whatever had been wrong with her this morning was worse tonight, much worse. He realized he was seeing her with all her masks put aside. This was the real Annie, the inside Annie. The flesh of her face, which had previously seemed so fearsomely solid, now hung like lifeless dough. Her eyes were blanks. She had dressed, but her skirt was on inside out. There were more wheels on her flesh, more furrows. When she moved, they exhaled too many different aromas for Paul to count. Nearly one whole arm of her cardigan sweater was soaked with a half-dried substance that smelled like gravy. She held up the trap. "They come into the cellar when it rains." The pinned rat squeaked feebly and snapped at the air. Its black eyes, infinitely more lively than those of its captor, rolled. "I put down traps. I have to. I smear the triplates with bacon grease. I always catch 8 or 9. Sometimes I find others." She blanked then. Blanked for nearly 3 minutes, holding the rat in the air, a perfect case of waxy catatonia. Paul stared at her, stared at the rat as it squeaked and struggled, and realized that he had actually believed that things could get no worse. untrue. Unfucking true. At last, as he had begun to think she had just sailed off into oblivion forever with no fuss or fanfare, she lowered the trap and went on as if she had never stopped speaking. Drowned in the corners. Poor things. She looked down at the rug. A tear fell onto its matted fur. Poor, poor things. She closed one of her strong hands around the rat and pulled back the spring with the other. It lashed in her hand, head twisting as it tried to bite her. Its squeals were thin and terrible. Paul pressed the heel of a palm against his wincing mouth. How its heart beats. How it struggles to get away. As we do, Paul. As we do. We think we know so much. But we really don't know any more than a rat in a trap. A rat with a broken back that thinks it still wants to live. The hand holding the rat became a fist. Her eyes never lost that blank, distant cast. Paul wanted to look away and could not. Tendons began to stand out on her inner arm. Blood ran from the rat's mouth in an abrupt, thin stream. Paul heard its bones break, and then the thick pads of her fingers punched into its body, disappearing up to the first. Blood pattered on the floor. The creature's dulling eyes bulged. She tossed the body into the corner and wiped her hand indifferently on the sheet, leaving long red smears. Now it's at peace. She shrugged, then laughed.
I'll get my gun, Paul, shall I? Maybe the next world is better. For rats and people both. Not that there's much difference between the two.
Not until I finish, he said, trying to enunciate each word carefully. This was difficult, because he felt as if someone had shot his mouth full of Novocaine. He had seen her low before, but he'd seen nothing like this. He wondered if she'd ever had a low as this. This before shooting all themselves, hot despair of a woman who dresses her children in their best, takes them out for a game, walks them down to the, lifts one into the crook of each arm, and jumps over the side. Depressives kill themselves. Psychotics, rocked in the poison cradles of their own egos, want to do everyone handy a favor and take them along. I'm closer to death than I've ever been in my life, he thought, because she means it. The bitch means it.
Misery? She asked, almost as if she had never heard the word before.
But there had been a momentary fugitive sparkle in her eyes, hadn't there? He thought so. Misery, yes. He thought desperately about how he should go on. Every possible approach seemed mined. I agree that the world is a pretty crappy place most of the time, he said, and then added inanely, especially when it rains. Oh, you idiot. Stop babbling. I mean, I've been in a lot of pain these last few weeks, and
pain?
She looked at him with sallow, sunken contempt.
You don't know what pain is. You haven't the slightest idea, Paul.
No, I suppose not. Not compared to you.
That's right. But I want to finish this book. I want to see how it all turns out.
He paused. And I'd like you to stick around and see, too. A person might as well not write a book at all if there's no one around to read it. Do you get me? He lay there looking at that terrible stone face, heart thumping. Annie, do you get me?
Yes, she sighed. I do want to know how it comes out. That's the only thing left in the world that I still want, I suppose.
Slowly, apparently unaware of what she was doing, she began to suck the rat's blood from her fingers. Paul jammed his teeth together and grimly told himself he would not vomit. Would not. would not. It's like waiting for the end of those chapter plays. She looked around suddenly, the blood on her mouth like lipstick. Let me offer again, Paul. I can get my gun. I can end all of this for both of us. You are not a stupid man. I can't let you leave here. You've known that for some time, haven't you? Don't let your eyes waver. If she sees your eyes waver, she'll kill you right now. Yes. But it always ends, doesn't it, Annie? In the end, we all swing. A ghost of a smile at the corners of her mouth. She touched his face briefly, with some affection. I suppose you think of escape. So does a rat in a trap, I'm sure, in its way. But you're not going to Paul. He might if this was one of your stories, but it's not. I can't let you leave here. But I could go with you. And suddenly, for just a moment, he thought of saying, All right, Annie, go ahead. Let's just call it off. Then his need and will to live, and there was still quite a lot of it in him, rose up and clamored the momentary weakness away. Weakness was what it was. Weakness and cowardice. Fortunately or unfortunately, he did not have the crutch of mental illness to fall back on. Thank you, he said. But I want to finish what I've started. She sighed and stood up. All right. I suppose I must have known you would, because I see I brought you some pills, although I don't remember doing it. She laughed, a small, crazy titter which seemed to come from that slack face as if by ventriloquism. I'll have to go away for a while. If I don't, what you or I want won't matter, because I do things. I have a place I go when I feel like this. A place in the hills. Did you ever read the Uncle Remus stories, Paul? He nodded. You remember Br'er Rabbit telling Br'er Fox about his laughing place? Yes. That's what I call my place up country. My laughing place. Remember how I said I was coming back from Sidewinder when I found you? He nodded. Well, that was a fib. I fibbed because I didn't know you well then. I was really coming back from my laughing place. It has a sign over the door that says that. Annie's Laughing Place, it says. Sometimes I do laugh when I go there. But mostly I just scream. How long will you be gone, Annie? She was drifting dreamily toward the door now. I can't tell. I brought you pills. You'll be all right. Take 2 every 6 hours, or 6 every 4 hours, or all of them at once. But what will I eat? He wanted to ask her and didn't. He didn't want her attention to return to him, not at all. He wanted her gone. Being here with her was like being with the angel of death. He lay stiffly in his bed for a long time, listening to her movements, first upstairs and then on the stairs, then in the kitchen, fully expecting her to change her mind and come back with a gun after all. He did not even relax when he heard the side door slam and lock, followed by splashing steps outside. The gun could just as easily be in the Cherokee. Old Bessie's motor whirred and caught. Annie gunned it fiercely. A fan of headlights came on, illuminating a shiny silver curtain of rain. The lights began to retreat down the driveway. They swung around, dimming, and then Annie was gone. This time she was not headed downhill toward Sidewinder, but up into the high country. Go into her laughing place, Paul croaked, and began to laugh himself. She had hers. He was already in his. The wild gales of mirth ended when he looked at the mangled body of the rat in the corner. A thought struck him. Who said she didn't leave me anything to eat? He asked the room, and laughed even harder. In the empty house, Paul Sheldon's laughing place sounded like the padded cell of a madman. Two hours later, Paul jimmied the bedroom's lock again, and for the second time forced the wheelchair through the doorway that was almost too small. For the last time, he hoped. He had a pair of blankets in his lap. All the pills he had cached under the mattress were wrapped in a Kleenex tucked into his underwear. He meant to get out if he could, rain or no rain. This was his chance, and this time he meant to take it. Sidewinder was downhill, and the road would be slippery in the rain, and it was darker than a mine shaft. He meant to try it all the same. He hadn't lived the life of a hero or a saint, but he did not intend to die like an exotic bird in a zoo. He vaguely remembered an evening he'd spent drinking scotch with a gloomy playwright named Bernstein at the Lion's Head, down in the village. And if he lived to see the village again, he would get down on whatever remained of his knees and kiss the grimy sidewalk of Christopher Street. At some point, the conversation had turned to the Jews living in Germany, during the uneasy 4 or 5 years before the Wehrmacht rolled into Poland and the festivities began in earnest. Paul remembered telling Bernstein, who had lost an aunt and a grandfather in the Holocaust, that he didn't understand why the Jews in Germany, hell all over Europe, but especially in Germany, hadn't gotten out while there was still time. They were not, by and large, stupid people, and many had had a first-hand experience of such persecution. Surely they had seen what was coming, so why had they stayed? Bernstein's answer had struck him as frivolous and cruel and incomprehensible. Most of them had pianos. We Jews are very partial to the piano. When you own a piano, it's harder to think about moving. Now he understood. Yes. At first it was his broken legs and crushed pelvis. Then, God help him, the book had taken off. In a crazy way, he was even having fun with it. It would be easy, too easy, to blame everything on his broken bones or the dope, when in fact so much of it had been the book. That and the droning passage of days and their simple convalescent pattern. Those things, but mostly the stupid goddamn book, had been his piano. What would she do if he was gone when she came back from her laughing place? Burn the manuscript? I don't give a fuck, he said. And this was almost the truth. If he lived, he could write another book, recreate this one even if he wanted to. But a dead man couldn't write a book any more than he could buy a new piano. He went into the parlor. It had been tidy before, but now there were dirty dishes stacked on every available surface. It looked to Paul as if everyone in the house must be here. Annie apparently not only pinched and slapped herself when she was feeling depressed. It looked like she really... And never mind cleaning up after. He half remembered the stinking wind that had blown down his throat during the time in the cloud, and felt his stomach clench. Most of the remains were of sweet things. Ice cream had dried or was drying in many of the bowls and soup dishes. There were crumbs of cake and smears of pie on the plates. A mound of lime jello, covered with a cracked glaze of dried whipped cream, stood on top of the TV, next to a 2-liter plastic bottle of Pepsi and a gravy boat. The Pepsi bottle looked almost as big as the nose cone of a Titan II rocket. Its surface was dull and smeary, almost opaque. He guessed she had drunk directly from it, and that her fingers had been covered with gravy or ice cream when she did it. He had not heard the clink of silverware, and that was not surprising, because there was none here. Dishes and bowls and plates, but no cutlery. He saw drying drips and splashes, again mostly of ice cream, on the rug and couch. That was what I saw on her housecoat, the stuff she was eating, and what was on her breath. His image of Annie as Piltdown Woman recurred. He saw her sitting in here and scooping ice cream into her mouth, or maybe handfuls of half-congealed chicken gravy with a Pepsi chaser, simply eating and drinking in a deep, depressed daze. The penguin sitting in its block of ice was still on the knick-knack table, but she had thrown many of the other ceramic pieces into the corner, where their littered remains were scattered, sharp little hooks and shards. He kept seeing her fingers as they sank into the rat's body, the red smears of her fingers on the sheet. He kept seeing her licking the blood from her fingers, doing it absently as she must have eaten the ice cream and jello and soft black jelly roll cake. These images were terrible, but they were a wonderful incentive to hurry. The spray of dried flowers on the coffee table had overturned. Beneath the table, barely visible, lay a dish of crusted custard pudding and a large book. Memory Lane, it said. Trips down memory lane when you're feeling depressed are never a very good idea, Annie. But I suppose you know that by this point in your life. He rolled across the room. Straight ahead was the kitchen. On the right, a wide, short hallway went down to Annie's front door. Beside this hallway, a flight of stairs went up to the second floor. Giving the stairs only a brief glance, there were drips of ice cream on some of the carpeted stair levels and glazy smears of it on the banister. Paul rolled down to the door. He thought that if there was going to be a way out for him, tied to his chair as he was, it would be by way of the kitchen door, the one she galloped from when Mr. Rancho Grande showed up. But he ought to check this one. He might get a surprise. He didn't. The porch stairs were every bit as steep as he had feared. But even if there had been a wheelchair ramp, a possibility he never would have accepted in a spirited game of Can You, even if a friend had suggested it, he couldn't have used it. There were three locks on the door. The police bar he could have coped with. The other two were Krieg's, the best locks in the whole world, according to his ex-cop friend Tom Twyford. And where were the keys? Let me see. On their way to Annie's laughing place, maybe. Yes, sirree, Bob. Give that man a cigar and a blowtorch to light it with. He reversed down the hall, fighting panic, reminding himself he hadn't expected much from the front door anyway. He pivoted the chair once he was in the parlor and rolled into the kitchen. This was an old-fashioned room with bright linoleum on the floor and a pressed tin ceiling. The refrigerator was old but quiet. There were three or four magnets stuck to its door. Not surprisingly, they all looked like candy. A piece of bubble gum, a Hershey bar, a Tootsie Roll. One of the cabinet doors was open, and he could see shelves neatly covered with oilcloth. There were big windows over the sink, and they would let in a lot of light even on cloudy days. It should have been a cheery kitchen, but wasn't. The garbage can overflowed onto the floor and emitted the warm reek of spoiling food. But that wasn't the only thing wrong, or the worst smell. There was another that seemed to exist mostly in his mind, but which was no less real for that. It was Parfum de Wilkes, a psychic odor of obsession. There were three doors in the room, two to the left and one straight ahead, between the refrigerator and the pantry alcove. He went to those on the left first. One was the kitchen closet. He knew that even before he saw the coats, hats, scarves, and boots. The brief yapping squeak of the hinges was enough to tell him. The other was the one Annie used to go out. And here was another police bar and two more Kriegs. Roydman, stay out. Paul, stay in. He imagined her laughing. You fucking bitch! He struck his fist against the side of the door. It hurt, and he pressed the side of his hand against his mouth. He hated the sting of tears, the momentary doubling of his vision when he blinked, but there was no way he could stop it. The panic was yammering more loudly now, asking what he was going to do. What was he going to do, for Christ's sake? This might be his last chance. What I'm going to do first is a thorough job of checking the situation out, he told himself grimly. If you can stay cool for just a while longer, that is. Think you can do that, chicken shit? He wiped his eyes. Crying was not going to get him out of this. He looked out through the window which made up the top half of the door. It wasn't really just one window, but 16 small panes. He could break the glass in each, but he would have to bust the lathes, too, and that might take hours without a saw. They looked strong. And what then? A kamikaze dive out onto the back porch? A great idea. Maybe he could break his back, and that would take his mind off his legs for a while. And it wouldn't take long lying out there in the pelting rain before he died of exposure. That would take care of the whole rotten business. No way. No fucking way. Maybe I'm going to punch out, but I swear to God, I'm not going to do it until I get a chance to show my number one fan just how much I've enjoyed getting to know her. And that isn't just a promise. That's a sacred vow. The idea of paying Annie back did more to still his panic than any amount of self-scolding had done. A little calmer, he flicked the switch beside the locked door. It turned on an outside light, which came in handy. The last of the daylight had drained away during the time since he had left his room. Annie's driveway was flooded, and her yard was a quagmire of mud, standing water, and gobbets of melting snow. By positioning his wheelchair all the way to the left of the door, he could for the first time see the road which ran by her place, although it was really no big deal. Two-lane blacktop between decaying snowbanks, shiny as sealskin and awash with rainwater and snowmelt. Maybe she locked the doors to keep the Roidmans out, but she sure didn't need to lock them to keep me in. If I got out there in this wheelchair, I'd be bogged to the hubcaps in 5 seconds. You're not going anywhere, Paul. Not tonight, probably not for weeks. There'll be a month into the baseball season before the ground firms up enough for you to get out to the road in this wheelchair. Unless you want to crash through a window and crawl. No, he didn't want to do that. It was too easy to imagine how his shattered bones would feel after 10 or 15 minutes of wriggling through cold puddles and melting snow like a dying tadpole. And even supposing he could make it out to the road, what were his chances of flagging down a car? The only two he'd ever heard out there other than old Bessie had been El Rancho Grande's Bel Air and the car which had scared the life out of him passing the house on the first occasion he had escaped his guest room. He turned off the outside light and rolled across to the other door, the one between the refrigerator and the pantry. There were 3 locks on this one as well, and it didn't even open on the outside, or at least not directly. There was another light switch beside this door. Paul flicked it and saw a neat shed addition, which ran the length of the house on its windward side. One was a woodpile and a chopping block with an axe buried in it. At the other was a work table and tools hung on pegs. To its left there was another door. The bulb out there wasn't terribly bright, but it was bright enough for him to see another police bolt and another 2 Krieglocks on that door as well. The Roidmans. Everybody. All out to get me. I don't know about them, he said to the empty kitchen, but I sure am. Giving up on the doors, he rolled into the pantry. Before he looked at the food stored on the shelves, he looked at the matches. There were 2 cartons of paper book matches and at least 2 dozen boxes of diamond blue tips, neatly stacked up. For a moment, he considered simply lighting the place on fire, began to reject the ideas the most ridiculous yet, and then saw something which made him reconsider it briefly. In here was yet another door, and this one had no locks on it. He opened it, and saw a set of steep, rickety stairs pitching and yawing their way into the cellar. An almost vicious smell of dampness and rotting vegetables rose from the dark. He heard low, squeaking sounds, and thought of her saying, "They come into the cellar when it rains. I put down traps. I have to." He slammed the door shut in a hurry. A drop of sweat trickled down from his temple and ran stinging into the corner of his right eye. He knuckled it away. Knowing that door must lead to the cellar, and seeing that there were no locks on it, had made the idea of torching the place seem momentarily more rational. He could maybe shelter there. But the stairs were too steep. The possibility of being burned alive, if Annie's flaming house collapsed into the cellar hole before the Sidewinder fire engines could get here, was too real. And the rats down there. The sound of the rats was somehow worse. How its heart beats. How it struggles to get away. As we do, Paul. As we do. Africa, Paul said, and didn't hear himself say it. He began to look at the cans and bags of food in the pantry, trying to assess what he could take with the least chance of raising her suspicions next time she came out here. Part of him understood exactly what this assessment meant. He had given up the idea of escape. Only for the time being. His troubled mind protested. No. A deeper voice responded implacably. Forever, Paul. Forever. I will never give up, he whispered. Do you hear me? Never. Oh, no, the voice of the cynic whispered sardonically. Well, we'll see, won't we? Yes. They would see. Larder, more like a survivalist's bomb shelter than a pantry. He guessed that some of this hoarding was a simple nod to the realities of her situation. She was a woman alone living in the high country, where a person must reasonably expect to spend a certain, maybe only a day, but sometimes as long as a week or even two, cut off from the rest of the world. Probably even those cock-a-doodle Roydmans had a pantry that would make a homeowner from another part of the country raise his or her brows. But he doubted if the cock-a-doodle Roydmans or anyone else up here had anything which came close to what he was now looking at. This was no pantry. This was a goddamn supermarket. He supposed there was a certain symbolism in Annie's pantry. The ranks of goods had something to say about the murkiness of the borderline between the sovereign state of reality and the People's Republic of Paranoia. In his current situation, however, such niceties hardly seemed worth examination. Fuck the symbolism. Go for the food. Yes, but be careful. It wasn't just a matter of what she might miss. He must take no more than he could reasonably hope to hide if she came back suddenly. And how else did he think she would come? Her phone was dead, and he somehow doubted if Annie would send him a telegram or flowers by wire. But in the end, what she might miss in here or find in his room hardly mattered. After all, he had to eat. He was hooked on that, too. Sardines. There were lots of sardines in those flat rectangular cans with a key under the paper. Good. He would have some of those. Tins of deviled ham. No keys, but he could open a couple of cans in her kitchen and eat those first. Bury the empties deep in her own overflowing garbage. There was an open package of sun-made raisins containing smaller boxes, which the ad copy on the torn cellophane wrapper called mini-snacks. Paul added four of the mini-snacks to the growing stash in his lap, plus single-serving boxes of cornflakes and Wheaties. He noted there had been no single-serving boxes of pre-sweetened cereals. If there had been, Annie had chowed them down on her last binge. On a higher shelf was a pile of Slim Jims, as neatly stacked as the kindling in Annie's shed. He took four, trying not to disturb the pyramidal structure of the pile, and he ate one of them greedily, relishing the salty taste and the grease. He tucked the wrapping into his underwear for later disposal. His legs were beginning to hurt. He decided that if he wasn't going to escape or burn the house down, he ought to go on back to his room. An anticlimax, but things could be worse. He could take a couple of pills and then write until he got drowsy. Then he could go to sleep. He doubted if she would be back tonight. Far from abating, the storm was gaining strength. The idea of writing quietly and then sleeping with the knowledge that he was perfectly alone, that Annie was not going to burst in with some wild idea or even wilder demand, held great appeal. Anticlimax or not. He reversed out of the pantry, pausing to turn off the light, reminding himself that he must rinse, put everything back in order as he made his retreat. If he ran out of food before she came back, he could always return for more. Like a hungry rat, right, Polly? But he must not forget how careful he must be. It would not do to forget the simple fact that he was risking his life every time he left his room. Forgetting that would not do at all. As he was rolling across the parlor, the scrapbook under the coffee table caught his eye again. Memory Lane. It was as big as a folio Shakespeare play and as thick as a family Bible. Curious, he picked it up and opened it. On the first page was a single column of newsprint, headed Wilkes-Berryman Nuptials. There was a picture of a pale gent with a narrow face, and a woman with dark eyes and a pursy mouth. Paul glanced from the newspaper photo to the portrait over the mantel. No question. The woman identified in the clipping as Cressilda Berryman. Now there's a name worthy of a misery novel, he thought. Was Annie's mother. Neatly written in black ink below the clipping was Bakersfield Journal, May 30th, 1938. Page 2 was a birth announcement. Paul Emery Wilkes, born in Bakersfield Receiving Hospital, May 12, 1939. Father, Carl Wilkes. Mother, Cressilda Wilkes. The name of Annie's older brother gave him a start. He must have been the one with whom she had gone to the movies and seen the chapter plays. Her brother had been Paul, too. Page 3 announced the birth of Anne Marie Wilkes, D.O.B., April 1, 1943, which made Annie just past her 44th birthday. The fact that she had been born on April Fool's Day did not escape Paul. Outside, the wind gusted. Rain tore against the house. Fascinated, his pain temporarily forgotten, Paul turned the page. The next clipping was from page 1 of the Bakersfield Journal. The photo showed a fireman on a ladder, silhouetted against the background of flames billowing from the windows of a frame building. 5 die in apartment house fire. 5 persons, 4 of them members of the same family, died in the early hours of Wednesday morning, victims of a smoky 3-alarm fire in a Bakersfield apartment house on Watch Hill Avenue. 3 of the dead were children, Paul Krenmutz, 8, Frederick Krenmutz, 6, and Allison Krenmutz, 3. The 4th was their father, Adrian Krenmutz, 41. Mr. Krenmutz rescued the surviving Krenmutz child, Laureen Krenmutz, who was 18 months old. According to Mrs. Jessica Krenmutz, her husband put the youngest of their 4 children in her arms and told her, "I'll be back with the others in a minute or two. Pray for us." "I never saw him again," she said. The 5th victim, Irving Thalman, 58, was a bachelor who lived on the top floor of the building. The 3rd-floor apartment was vacant at the time of the fire. The Carl Wilkes family, at first listed as missing, left the building Tuesday night because of a water leak in the kitchen. "I weep for Mrs. Krenmutz and her loss," Griselda Wilkes told a Journal reporter, "but I thank God for sparing my husband and my own 2 children." Centralia Fire Chief Michael O'One said that the fire began in the apartment building's basement. When asked about the possibility of arson, he said, "It's more likely that a wino crept into the basement, had a few drinks, and accidentally started the fire with a cigarette. He probably ran instead of trying to put the fire out, and 5 people died. I hope we catch up with a bum." When asked about the leads, O'One said, "The police have several, and they're following them up hard and fast, I can tell you." The same neat black ink below the clipping. October 28, 1954. Paul looked up. He was totally still, but a pulse beat rapidly in his throat. His bowels felt loose and hot. Little brats. 3 of the dead were children. Mrs. Krenmutz's 4 brats downstairs. Oh, no. Oh, Christ, no. I used to hate those little brats. She was just a kid. Not even in the house. She was 11. Old enough and bright enough maybe to spill some kerosene around a cheap liquor bottle, then light a candle and put the candle in the middle of the kerosene. Maybe she didn't even think it would work. Maybe she thought the kerosene would evaporate before the candle burned all the way down. Maybe she thought they'd get out alive. Only wanted to scare them into moving. But she did it, Paul. She fucking did it. And you know it. Yes, he supposed he did. And who would suspect her? He turned the page. Here was yet another Bakersfield Journal clipping. This one dated July 19, 1957. It featured a picture of Carl Wilkes looking slightly older. One thing was clear. It was as old as he was ever going to get. The clipping was his obituary. Bakersfield accountant dies in freak fall. Carl Wilkes, a longtime Bakersfield resident, died shortly after being admitted to Hernandez General Hospital last night. He apparently stumbled over a pile of loose clothing, which had been left on the stairs earlier, while on his way down to answer the phone. Dr. Frank Canley, the admitting physician, said that Wilkes died of multiple skull fractures and a broken neck. He was 44. Wilkes is survived by his wife, Cressilda, a son, Paul, 18, and a daughter, Anne, 14. When Paul turned to the next page, he thought for a moment that Annie had pasted in 2 copies of her father's obituary out of sentiment or by accident. He thought this latter the more likely possibility of the 2. But this was a different accident, and the reason for the similarity was simplicity itself. Neither had really been an accident at all. He felt stark and simple terror steal into him. The neat handwriting below this clipping read, Los Angeles Call, January 29, 1962. USC student dies in freak fall. Andrea St. James, a USC nursing student, was pronounced dead on arrival at Mercy Hospital in North Los Angeles last night, the apparent victim of a bizarre accident. Miss St. James shared an off-campus apartment on DeLorme Street with a sister nursing student, Ann Wilkes of Bakersfield. Shortly before 11 p.m., Miss Wilkes heard a brief scream, followed by terrible thudding sounds. Miss Wilkes, who had been studying, rushed onto the third-floor landing and saw Miss St. James lying on the landing below, sprawled in a very unnatural position. Miss Wilkes said that in her effort to render aid, she almost fell herself. "We had a cat named Peter Gunn," she said, "only we hadn't seen him for days and thought the pound must have gotten him because we kept forgetting to get him a tag. He was lying dead on the stairs. It was the cat she tripped over. I covered Andrea with my sweater and then called the hospital. I knew she was dead, but I didn't know who else to call." Miss St. James, a native of Los Angeles, was 21. "Jesus." Paul whispered it over and over. His hand was shaking badly as he turned the page. Here was a call clipping which said that the stray cat the student nurses adopted had been poisoned. Peter Gunn. Cute name for a cat, Paul thought. The landlord had rats in his basement. Tenant complaints had resulted in a warning from the building inspectors the year before. The landlord had caused a ruckus at a subsequent city council meeting, which had been lively enough to get coverage in the papers. Annie would have known. Faced with a stiff fine by councilmen who didn't like being called names, the landlord had sown the cellar with poison bait. Cat eats poison. Cat languishes in cellar for 2 days. Cat then crawls as close to his mistresses as possible before expiring, and killing one of said mistresses. An irony worthy of Paul Harvey, Paul Sheldon thought, and laughed wildly. I bet it made his daily newscast, too. Neat. Very neat. Except we know that Annie picked up some of the poisoned bait in the cellar and hand-fed it to the cat. And if old Peter Gunn didn't want to eat it, she probably rammed it down his gullet with a stick. When he was dead, she put him on the stairs and hoped it would work. Maybe she had a pretty good idea her roommate would come home tiddly. I wouldn't be a bit surprised. A dead cat, a heap of clothes. Same M.O., as Tom Twyford would say. But why, Annie? These clippings tell me everything but that. Why? In an act of self-preservation, part of his imagination had, over the last few weeks, actually become Annie, and it was now this Annie part that spoke up in its dry and uncontradictable voice. And while what it said was perfectly mad, it also made perfect sense. I killed her because she played her radio late at night. I killed her because of the dumb name she gave the cat. I killed her because I got tired of seeing her soul kissing her boyfriend on the couch, him with his hand shoved so far up her skirt he looked like he was prospecting for gold. I killed her because I caught her cheating. I killed her because she caught me cheating. The specifics don't matter, do they? I killed her because she was a cock-a-doody brat, and that was reason enough. And maybe because she was a Mrs. Smart Guy, Paul whispered. He threw back his head and donkeyed another shrill and frightened laugh. So this was Memory Lane, was it? Oh, what a variety of strange and poisonous flowers grew beside Annie's version of that quaint old path. No one ever put those two freak falls together? First her father, then her roommate? Are you seriously telling me that? Yes, he was seriously telling himself that. The accidents had happened almost 5 years apart in 2 different towns. They'd been reported by different papers in a populous state where people were probably always falling downstairs and breaking their necks. And she was very, very clever. Almost as clever as Satan himself, it seemed. Only now she was starting to lose it. It would be precious little consolation to him, however, if Annie were to be finally brought to bay for the murder of Paul Sheldon. He turned the page and discovered another clipping from the Bakersfield Journal, the last, as it turned out. The headline read, Miss Wilkes is nursing school graduate. Hometown girl makes good. May 17th, 1966. The photo was of a younger, startlingly pretty Annie Wilkes, wearing a nurse's uniform and cap, smiling into the camera. It was a graduation photograph. Of course. She had graduated with honors. Only had to kill one roommate to do it, too, Paul thought, and donkeyed his shrill, frightened laugh. The wind gusted around the side of the house as if in answer. Mom's picture chattered briefly on the wall. The next cutting was from the Manchester, New Hampshire Union Leader, March 2, 1969. It was a simple obituary which seemed to have no connection with Annie Wilkes at all. Ernest Gagnier, age 79, had died in St. Joseph's Hospital. No exact cause of death given. After a long illness, the obit said. Survived by his wife, 12 children, and what looked like about 400 grandchildren and great-grandchildren. There was nothing like the rhythm method for producing all descendants great and small, Paul thought, and donkeyed again. She killed him. That's what happened to good old Ernie. Why else is his obituary here? This is Annie's Book of the Dead, isn't it? Why, for God's sake? Why? With Annie Wilkes, that is a question which has no sane answer, as you well know. Another page, another Union Leader obit. March 19, 1969. The lady was identified as Hester Queenie Bulifant, 84. In the picture, she looked like something whose bones might have been exhumed from the La Brea tar pits. The same thing that had gotten Ernie had gotten Queenie. Seemed like that long illness shit was going around. Like Ernie, she had expired at St. Joe's. Viewings at 2 and 6 p.m. on March 20th at Foster's Funeral Home. Interment at Mary Sire Cemetery on March 21st at 4 p.m. Ought to have had a special rendition of Annie, Won't You Come By Here, sung by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, Paul thought, and did the donkey some more. There were three more Union Leader bits on the following pages. Two old men who had died of that perennial favorite, long illness. The third was a woman of 46 named Paulette Simoe. Paulette had died of that common runner-up, short illness. Although the picture accompanying the obit was even grainier and fuzzier than usual, Paul saw that Paulette Simoe made Queenie Bulifant look like Thumbelina. He thought her illness might have been short indeed. A thunderclap coronary, say, followed by a trip to St. Joe's. Followed by what? Exactly what? He really didn't want to think about the specifics, but all three obits identified St. Joseph's as the place of expiration. And if we looked at the nurse's register from March 1969, would we find the name Wilkes? Friends, does a bear go cock-a-doodle in the woods? This book, dear God, this book was so big. No more, please. I don't want to look at any more. I've got the idea. I'm going to put this book down exactly where I found it. And I'm going into my room. I guess I don't want to write after all. I think I'll just take an extra pill and go to bed. Call it nightmare insurance. But no farther down Annie's memory lane, if you please. Please, if you please. But his hands seemed to have a mind and a will of their own. They kept on turning the pages, faster and faster. Two more brief death notices in the Union Leader, one in late September of 1969, one in early October. March 19, 1970. This one was from the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania Herald, a back page. New hospital staff announced. There was a photo of a balding, bespectacled man who looked to Paul like the type of fellow who might eat boogers in secret. The article noted that in addition to the new publicity director, the balding, bespectacled fellow, 20 others had joined the staff of Riverview Hospital. 2 doctors, 8 RNs, assorted kitchen staff, orderlies, and a janitor. Annie was one of the RNs. On the next page, Paul thought, I'm going to see a brief death notice for an elderly man or woman who expired at Riverview Hospital in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Correct. An old duffer who had died of that all-time favorite, long illness, followed by an elderly man who had died of that perennial bridesmaid, short illness, followed by a child of 3 who had fallen down a well, sustained grievous head injuries, and been brought to Riverview in a coma. Numbly, Paul continued to turn the pages while the wind and rain drove against the house. The pattern was inescapable. She got a job, killed some people, and moved on. Suddenly an image came, one from a dream his conscious mind had already forgotten, which thus gained the Delphic resonance of déjà vu. He saw Annie Wilkes in a long apron dress, her hair covered with a mob cap, and Annie, who looked like a nurse in London's Bedlam Hospital. She held a basket over one arm. She dipped into it, brought out sand and flung it into the upturned face as she passed. This was not the soothing sand of sleep, but poison sand. It was killing them. When it struck them, their faces went white, and the lines on the machines monitoring their precarious lives went flat. Maybe she killed the Krenmutz kids because they were brats, and her roommate. Maybe even her own father. But these others? But he knew. The Annie in him knew. Old and sick. All of them had been old and sick except Mrs. Simo. She must have been nothing but a vegetable when she came in. Mrs. Simo and the kid who had fallen down the well. Annie had killed them because they were rats in a trap, he whispered. Poor things. Poor, poor things. Sure, that was it. In Annie's view, all the people in the world were divided into three groups: rats, poor, poor things, and Annie. She had moved steadily westward, Harrisburg to Pittsburgh to Duluth to Fargo, then in 1978 to Denver. In each case, the pattern was the same. A Welcome Aboard article in which Annie's name was mentioned among others. She had missed the Manchester Welcome Aboard, probably because, Paul guessed, she hadn't known that local newspapers printed such things. Then two or three unremarkable deaths. Following these, the cycle would... Until Denver, that was. At first, it seemed the same. There was the New Arrivals article, this time clipped from the in-house newspaper of Denver's receiving hospital, with Annie's name mentioned. The in-house paper was identified in Annie's neat hand as the Gurney. Great name for a hospital paper, Paul told the empty room. Surprised no one thought of calling it the stool sample. He donkeyed more terrified laughter, all unaware. Turned the page, and here was the first obit, cut from the Rocky Mountain News. Laura D. Rothberg, long illness, September 21st, 1978. Denver Receiving Hospital. Then the pattern broke wide open. The next page announced a wedding instead of a funeral. The photo showed Annie, not in her uniform, but in a white dress frothing with lace. Beside her, holding her hands in his, was a man named Ralph Dugan. Dugan was a physical therapist. Dugan Wilkes Nuptials, the clipping was headed. Rocky Mountain News, January 2, 1979. Dugan was quite unremarkable, save for one thing. He looked like Annie's father. Paul thought if you shaved off Dugan's single-bar mustache, the resemblance would be just short of uncanny. Thickness of the remaining pages in Annie's book, and thought Ralph Dugan should have checked his horoscope. Whoops, make that horoscope. The day he proposed Annie. I think the chances are very good that somewhere up ahead in these unturned pages, I'm going to find a brief article about you. Some people have appointments in Samara. I think you may well have had one with a pile of laundry or a dead cat on a flight of stairs. A dead cat with a cute... The next clipping was a New Arrivals from the Nederland News. Nederland was a small town just west of Boulder. Not all that far from here, Paul judged. For a moment, he couldn't find Annie in the short, name-filled clipping, and then realized he was looking for the wrong name. She was here, but had become part of a socio-sexual corporation called Mr. and Mrs. Ralph Dugan. Paul's head snapped up. Was that a car coming? No, just the wind. Surely the wind. He looked back down at Annie's book. Ralph Dugan had gone back to helping the lame, the halt, and the blind at Arapahoe County Hospital. Presumably Annie went back to that time-honored nurse's job of giving aid and comfort to the grievously wounded. Now the killing starts, he thought. The only real question is about Ralph. Does he come at the beginning, in the middle, or at the end? But he was wrong again. Instead of an obit, the next clipping showed a Xerox of a realtor's one sheet. In the upper left corner of the ad was a photo of a house. Paul recognized it only by the attached barn. He had, after all, never seen the house itself from the outside. Beneath, in Annie's neat, firm hand, earnest money paid back March 3, 1979. Papers passed March 18, 1979. Retirement home? Paul doubted it. Summer place? No. They couldn't afford the luxury. So? Well, maybe it was just a fantasy, but try this. Maybe she really loves old Ralph Dugan. Maybe a year has passed and she still can't smell cock-a-doodle on him. Something has sure changed. There have been no obituaries since... He flicked back to see. Since Laura Rothberg in September 1978. She stopped killing around the same time she met Ralph. But that was then and this is now. Now the pressure is starting to build up again. The depressive interludes are coming back. She looks at the old people, the terminally ill. And she thinks about what poor, poor things they are. And maybe she thinks, it's this environment that's depressing me. The miles of tiled corridor and the smells and the squeak of crepe-soled shoes and the sounds of people in pain. If I could get out of this place, I'd be all right. So Ralph and Annie had apparently gone back to the land. He turned the page and blinked. Slashed into the bottom of the page was Aug 4-3rd, 1880, fuck you. The paper, thick as it was, had torn in several places under the fury of the hand which had driven the pen. It was the divorces granted column from the Nederland paper, but he had to turn it over to make sure that Annie and Ralph were a part of it. She had pasted it in, upside down. Yes, here they were. Ralph and Ann Dugan. Grounds. Mental cruelty. Divorced after a short illness, Paul muttered, and again looked up, thinking he heard an approaching car. The wind. Only the wind. Still, he'd better get back to the safety of his room. It wasn't just the worsening pains in his leg. He was edging toward a state of terminal freakout. But he bent over the book again. In a weird way, it was just too good to put down. It was like a novel so disgusting you just have to finish it. Annie's marriage had been dissolved in a much more legal fashion than Paul had anticipated. It seemed fair to say that the divorce really had been after a short illness. A year and a half of wedded bliss wasn't all that much. They had bought a house in March, and that was not a step you took if you felt that your marriage was falling apart. What happened? Paul didn't know. He could have made up a story, but a story was all it would have been. Then he read the clipping again. He noticed something suggestive. Angela Ford from John Ford. Christian Frawley from Stanley Frawley. Dana McLaren from Lee McLaren. And Ralph Dugan from Ann Dugan. There's this American custom, right? No one talks about it much, but it's there. Men propose in the moonlight. Women file in court. That's not always how it works, but usually that's it. So what tale does this grammatical structure have to tell? Angela's saying, slip out the back, Jack. Kirsten is saying, make a new plan, Stan. Dana is saying, drop off the key, Lee. And what was Ralph, the only man who's listed first in this column, saying? I think maybe he was saying, let me the hell out of here. Maybe he saw the dead cat on the stairs, Paul said. Next page. Another new arrivals article. This one was from the Boulder, Colorado Camera. There was a photograph of a dozen new staff members standing on the lawn of the Boulder Hospital. Annie was in the second row, her face a blank white circle under her cap with its black stripe. Another opening of another show. The date underneath was March 9, 1981. She had retaken her maiden name. Boulder. That was where Annie really had gone crazy. He turned the pages faster and faster, his horror mounting. And the two thoughts which kept repeating were, why in God's name didn't they tip faster? and how in God's name did she slip through their fingers? May 10th, 1981, long illness. May 14th, 1981, long illness. May 23rd, long illness. June 9th, short illness. June 15th, short. June 16th, long. Short, long, long, short, long, long, short. The pages stuttered through his fingers. He could smell the faint odor of dried paper paste. Christ, how many did she kill? If it was right to equate each obituary pasted in this book with a murder, then her score was more than 30 people by the end of 1981, all without a single murmur from the authorities. Of course, most of the victims were old, the rest badly hurt, but still, you would think. In 1982, Annie had finally stumbled. The clipping from the January 14th camera showed her blank, stone-like face rendered in newsprint dots below a headline which read, "New Head Maternity Ward Nurse Named." On January 29th, the nursery deaths had begun. Annie had chronicled the whole story in her meticulous way. Paul had no trouble following it. If the people after your hide had found this book, Annie, you would have been in jail or some asylum until the end of time. The first two infant deaths had not aroused suspicion. A story on one had mentioned severe birth defects. But babies, defective or not, weren't the same as old folks dying of renal failure, or car crash victims, brought in still somehow alive in spite of heads which were only half there, or steering wheel-sized holes in their guts. And then she had begun killing the healthy along with the damaged. He supposed that in her deepening psychotic spiral, she had begun to see all of them as poor, poor things. By mid-March of 1982, there had been five nursery deaths in the Boulder Hospital. A full-scale investigation was launched. On March 24th, the camera named the probable culprit as Tainted Formula. A reliable hospital source was cited, and Paul wondered if perhaps the source had not been Annie Wilkes herself. Another baby had died in April. Two in May. Then from the front page of the June 1st Denver Post, head maternity nurse questioned on infant deaths. No charges made as yet, sheriff's office spokeswoman says, by Michael Leith. Ann Wilkes, the 39-year-old head nurse of the maternity ward at Boulder Hospital, is being questioned today about the deaths of eight infants, deaths which have taken place over a span of some months. All of the deaths took place following Miss Wilkes' appointment. When asked if Miss Wilkes was under arrest, Sheriff's Office spokeswoman, Tamara Consolving, said she was not. When asked if Miss Wilkes had come in of her own free will to give information in the case, Miss Consolving replied, "I would have to say that was not the case. Things are a bit more serious than that." Asked if Wilkes had been charged with any crime, Miss Consolving replied, "No, not as yet." The rest of the article was a rehash of Annie's career. It was obvious that she had moved around a lot, but there was no hint that people in all of Annie's hospitals, not just the one in Boulder, had a way of croaking when she was around. He looked at the accompanying photograph, fascinated. Annie in custody. Dear God, Annie in custody. The idol had not fallen, but teetering. Teetering. She was mounting a set of stone steps in the company of a husky policewoman, her face dull, devoid of expression. She was wearing her nurse's uniform and white shoes. Next page, Wilkes released, mum on interrogation. She'd gotten away with it. Somehow she'd gotten away with it. It was time for her to fade out and show up someplace else. Idaho, Utah, California maybe. Dead, she went back to work. And instead of a new arrivals column from somewhere farther west, there was a huge headline from the Rocky Mountain News, front page of July 2, 1982. The horror continues. Three more infant deaths in Boulder Hospital. 2 days later, the authorities arrested a Puerto Rican orderly, only to release him 9 hours later. Then on July 19th, both the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News announced Annie's arrest. There had been a short preliminary hearing in early August. On September 9th, she went on trial for the murder of girl Christopher, a female child 1 day of age. Behind girl Christopher were seven other counts of first-degree murder. The article noted that some of Annie's alleged victims had even lived long enough to be given real names. Interspersed among the accounts of the trial were letters to the editor printed in the Denver and Boulder newspapers. Paul understood that Annie had been driven to cull only the most hostile ones, those which reinforced her jaundiced view of mankind as homo bratus. But they were vituperative by any standards. There seemed to be a consensus. Hanging was too good for Annie Wilkes. One correspondent dubbed her the Dragon Lady, and the name stuck for the duration of the trial. Most seemed to feel that the Dragon Lady should be jabbed to death with hot forks, and most indicated that they would be very willing to serve as a jabber. Beside one such letter, Annie had written in a shaky and somehow pathetic script, entirely unlike her usual firm hand. "Sticks, stones will break my bones. Words will never hurt me." It was apparent that Annie's biggest mistake had been not stopping when people finally realized something was going on. It was bad, but unfortunately not quite bad enough. The idol only tottered. The prosecution's case was entirely circumstantial, and in places thin enough to read a newspaper through. The district attorney had a hand mark on girl Christopher's face and throat, which corresponded to the size of Annie's hand, complete with a mark of the amethyst ring she wore on the fourth finger of her right hand. The DA also had a pattern of observed entries and exits to the nursery, which roughly corresponded to the infant deaths. But Annie was the head maternity nurse, after all, so she was always going in and out. Defense was able to show dozens of other occasions when Annie had entered the ward and nothing untoward had happened. Paul thought this was akin to proving that meteors never struck the earth, by showing 5 days when not a single one had hit Farmer John's north field, but he could understand the weight the argument would have carried with a jury just the same. The prosecution wove its net as well as it could, but the handprint with the mark of the ring was really the most damning bit of evidence it could come up with. The fact that the state of Colorado had elected to bring Annie to trial at all, given such a slight chance of conviction on the evidence, left Paul with one assumption and one certainty. The assumption was that Annie had said things during her original interrogation which were extremely suggestive, perhaps even damning. Her attorney had managed to keep the transcript of that interrogation out of the trial record. The certainty was that Annie's decision to testify in her own behalf at the preliminary hearing had been extremely unwise. That testimony her attorney hadn't been able to keep out of the trial, although he had nearly ruptured himself trying. And while Annie had never confessed to anything in so many words, during the 3 days in August she had spent up there on the stand in Denver, he thought that she had really confessed to everything. Excerpts from the clippings pasted in her book contained some real gems. "Did they make me feel sad? Of course they made me feel sad, considering the world we live in. I have nothing to be ashamed of. I am never ashamed. What I do, that's final. I never look back on that type of thing. Did I attend the funerals of any of them? Of course not. I find funerals very grim and depressing. Also, I don't believe babies are ensouled. No, I never cried. Was I sorry? I guess that's a philosophical question, isn't it? Of course I understand the question. I understand all your questions. I know you're all out to get me." If she had insisted on testifying in her own behalf at her trial, Paul thought, her lawyer probably would have shot her to shut her up. The case went to the jury on December 13, 1982. And here was a startling picture from the Rocky Mountain News, a photo of Annie sitting calmly in her holding cell and reading Misery's Quest. "In misery," the caption below asked. "Not the Dragon Lady." Annie reads calmly as she waits for the verdict. And then on December 16th, banner headlines, "Dragon Lady Innocent." In the body of the story, a juror who asked not to be identified was quoted. "I had very grave doubts as to her innocence, yes. Unfortunately, I had very reasonable doubts as to her guilt. I hope she will be tried again on one of the other counts. Perhaps the prosecution could make a stronger case on one of those. They all knew she did it, but nobody could prove it. So she slipped through their fingers." The case wound down over the next 3 or 4 pages. The DA said Annie surely would be tried on one of the other counts. 3 weeks later, he said he never said that. In early February of 1983, the district attorney's office issued a statement saying that while the cases of infanticide at the Boulder Hospital were still very much alive, the case against Annie Wilkes was closed. Slipped through their fingers. Her husband never testified for either side. Why was that, I wonder? There were more pages in the book, but he could tell by the snug way most lay against each other that he was almost done with Annie's history up to now. Thank God. The next page was from the Sidewinder Gazette, November 19, 1984. Hikers had found the mutilated and partly dismembered remains of a young man in the eastern section of Grider Wildlife Preserve. The following week's paper identified him as Andrew Pomeroy, age 23, of Coldstream Harbor, New York. Pomeroy had left New York for L.A. in September of the previous year, hitchhiking. His parents had last heard from him on